insane, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's good.
We are a Canadian podcast, and you may be wondering, do they have politics up in Canada? And do they ever? We have a prime minister. His name is Justin Trudeau from the Liberal Party.
Of Rolling Stone fame. That's where you will have heard of him from.
And he is currently embroiled in his third ethics investigation in 5 years. Let me see if I can set the table here. It stems from a program, a lovely program, that the Liberal Party was going to set up, you know, during the pandemic to connect university students to volunteer opportunities. And during this nice summer program, students would have received a grant, and this would have helped make up for all the summer job opportunities lost during the pandemic. And they were working with a wonderful charity, We Charity Canada, formerly Free the Children, who were going to administer the program. And it came out that, of course, members of Trudeau's family had been paid enormous sums of money over the years to speak at events for We and Free the Children. Trudeau himself had very close connections to the organization. Trudeau has claimed that his office had nothing to do with the hiring of We, that it was the choice of an independent arbiter. Of course, he's participating in an ethics investigation. It definitely seems like the kind of scandal that often hits the Liberal Party in this country, you know, petty corruption shit, insiderism, unseemly close relations between government and private companies. Luke, how is this similar to and different from other, particularly, let's say, Justin Trudeau scandals of recent years?
I guess it's kind of different in terms of scale. I mean, this and the SNC-Lavalin scandal that preceded the 2019 federal election are kind of the two biggest ones, but it has a lot of the same features. I did want to spend some time talking about this. We probably don't talk enough about Canada on this show, and this is really, you know, you probably will not have heard of this if you're part of the, I don't know, 60 to 70% of our audience that's in the United States. But this is kind of the biggest news story in Canada right now, certainly the biggest political news story. And Will's done a good job setting the table. I want to walk through a few kind of more specific details about this. This organization, We Charity, things started to break down when, you know, questions were raised about the program and its design. So why were people going to make less than the minimum wage? Things like that. Why does Justin Trudeau's wife, you know, host a podcast with this organization as an official ambassador for it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But then, you know, it didn't take long for once kind of the media smelt something for people to unearth all kinds of other connections. And I should say right off the bat here that the independent media organization Canada Land, which people will know if they listen to our episode with Jonathan Goldsby, who's an editor there. Canada Land's really been leading the reporting on this going back several years, whereas it's a very powerful organization, this charity. You know, it really has a foothold in school boards, in private industry, in government. You know, it's a very powerful and influential organization, you know, fronted by a celebrity. So Canada Land's reporting on this, you know, I think kind of fell on deaf ears, unfortunately, when it, I think, started in 2018. But once there was this controversy around the program, people started finding, you know, a whole lot more ties between the Trudeau government and this organization. So, you know, on June 26th, Trudeau put out a statement saying that he'd worked for the organization, quote, voluntarily, of course, and I will continue to do so, as will my family. Of course, the spirit of that statement very much contradicted by the revelation that both the prime minister's mother and his brother have been paid hundreds of thousands of dollars in speaking fees by this organization. The finance minister, Bill Morneau, was suddenly paying back $41,000 in paid travel and hospitality he'd got from this organization. He claimed that he, you know, forgot, which, you know, I'm not sure what to believe. Bill Morneau is incredibly wealthy, so he actually is the kind of person that might have just forgotten a $41,000 gift or something. One of Morneau's daughters works at We, and another one of his daughters, her book was blurred by Mark Kielberger, who's one of the two kind of faces of the organization. The Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, the Natural Resources Minister, Seamus O'Regan, also have ties to it, and both the Kielberger brothers, Mark and Craig, have made donations either to the Liberal Party or to Justin Trudeau. I think it was Craig donated to Trudeau's 2012 leadership campaign, which of course was ultimately successful. So much of the way this scandal is playing out in the press and is being discussed is as kind of a conflict of interest scandal. And I mean, I think there's good reason for that. That the really the key question has to do with whether the government designed this program with the intention of basically gifting it to the WE organization because of personal connections between the organization and members of the government. WE, like a lot of other charities during COVID, had really been suffering from a dearth of donations. There have been some leaks from within the organization which suggest that they laid off a whole bunch of people and then rehired a whole bunch of them before anything official was announced about, you know, them being given this this contract. Officially, you know, the official story is that the government was looking around to see who best could deliver this program. And of course, there's a whole other dimension here, which is, why in hell can't the Canadian federal government, like, is the Canadian state not equipped to administer a program like this itself? It's like a $900 million student grant program. And, you know, I think that's a kind of undervalued part of the story. Part of the ethos underlying something like this is the, you know, distinctly neoliberal one, which sees governments outsourcing everything and everything being done through these so-called public-private partnerships, which were very big in Ontario when the Liberals were in power. And many of the people who worked in that government are now staffing Trudeau's as well. So I think that's kind of an overlooked part of the story. But so there's been some speculation in the press that the government may have designed this program and tailored it specifically to the WE organization with the intention of throwing them a financial lifeline. That's the phrase used by, I think, John Iveson of the National Post. And as a conflict of interest scandal, I think some of the details of this are contested, but I think the basic contours of it are pretty clear. But in a piece I wrote recently for Jacobin, I wanted to come at it from a bit of a different angle, because it seems to me that whenever liberal scandals like this happen, liberal patronage scandals, they are always kind of processed in this conflict of interest kind of way. You know, it's all about the mundane details of who said what, when, you know, who got paid by whom, etc. And all of that stuff's important. And, you know, it's certainly the media's job to report it. But what kind of bothers me about this is when you process every scandal like that, and when you look upon every liberal scandal as if it's like the first one ever, and think about it only in relation to these kind of very specific details, I think you overlook something very important about the way Canadian politics have tended to function. This kind of insiderism is part and parcel of having one party in charge of the country for such a long time. American listeners especially may not know that the Liberal Party of Canada is pretty much the most successful party in the history of mass suffrage. I mean, the Liberals ran Canada. They were in government for a greater chunk of the 20th century than I think any equivalent party anywhere else. And I guess kind of more strictly Marxist terms, you might say that one of the distinctive features of Canada's party system is that it's one in which elites prefer to kind of negotiate within the confines of a single political party rather than two, you know, a la the Democrats and the Republicans or something like that. But there's so much at work in this scandal that I think really speaks to deeper parts of Canadian culture in politics and beyond. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that as well.
Central to the scandal is the figure of Craig Kilberger. I assume he is one of these elites you're talking about.
Well, Craig Kilberger is somebody that I guess a few people listening might have heard of. I mean, I certainly read about Craig Kilberger in my elementary school textbooks. Did you? Didn't you go to Catholic school? You definitely have heard about Craig Kilberger. I guess you were too busy watching like Woody Allen films or whatever to pay attention in school.
I only went to Catholic school for kindergarten. I went to public school for the rest. But we were told that Free the Children was a good charity. I do remember hearing that.
Right. So Free the Children was the predecessor to WE. I mean, it's the same thing, really, with a different name. And its figurehead is this guy, Craig Kilberger, who became kind of a child celebrity in the 90s. You know, he appeared on Oprah, on 60 Minutes. And, you know, his public image is that he's this crusader against child poverty. And he has this very mythologized origin story revolving around the case of a guy called Iqbal Masih, who was a former child laborer involved in Pakistan's carpet trade. Iqbal was allegedly murdered by the, quote, carpet mafia. And this story has really been central to Craig Kilberger's whole shtick since. From WE's website, Craig was 12, Iqbal was 12. In that moment, Greg was struck by a single and profound connection. Except for the happenstance of birth, he could have been Iqbal. He needed to do something. So there's a really good Canada Land investigation called Inside the Cult of Kielburger from 2018 that I would really encourage people to read. And it's one of several places that has reported that the actual details surrounding Iqbal Massey's death are very much disputed. In fact, this account that Kielburger has popularized is contradicted by local police and also one of the major human rights NGOs in Pakistan. Iqbal, it seems, was actually 19, so he wasn't 12, and his murder doesn't seem to have had anything to do with the carpet mafia. But you can still find videos of Craig Kielburger telling this story to, you know, legions of impressionable young people in these big stadiums, which brings me to, I guess, the next dimension of the scandal I wanted to discuss. And I think this is where things get really interesting. So you have the intersection of kind of charity and celebrity, and this really brings us to the way this organization is structured. It has a kind of bifurcated structure where it's really two organizations that are kind of working in tandem. So there's the We Charity, formerly Free the Children, which we've talked about. They do charitable work around the world, although don't have time to get into it here, but there's some dispute now about how much of the, you know, money spent on international development is actually really going to international development. So that's become part of the controversy too. But there's also this sort of corporate for-profit wing called Me to We. And this is actually really the public face of the organization. I mean, this is what people see. Me to We organizes so-called We Days, which are these big events that happen in elementary schools where the nation's children are told that, you know, it's your job to save the world, et cetera, et cetera. And the organization raises tons of money to bring celebrities like Chelsea Clinton, for some reason, Mikhail Gorbachev, celebrities.
Probably Malala, right?
I don't know if she's been involved. Jennifer Lopez, I think, was one of the other ones. But so they're paid six figures, or it costs six-figure fees to bring them to speak at these events. And you can watch them if you search any kind of like Craig Kielburger, We Day. You can see these things.
I'm stunned to hear this. I thought they did it for free. I thought this was charity stuff.
I don't know specifically if the We Days make money, but they are put on by the for-profit part of the organization, which generates revenue in other ways, you know, for example, selling sustainably made goods and hilariously marketing these extremely expensive voluntourism trips that offer, I think, you know, quite rich people given how much they cost. I mean, we're talking, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 for trips like, and I'm reading from the WE's web, from the website here, you can have the opportunity to, quote, step into the shoes of Maasai warriors in Kenya, or, quote, experience a shamanic ceremony and get hands-on weapons training in Ecuador.
And there's a charitable component to that, though, right? Like, do they go over and build a church or help build a school?
Yeah, in theory, there's some kind of vague pretense to charity. But when I was reading about what these trips were, I mean, it really seems like it's a way for it's the sort of upper middle class, you know, white savior equivalent of buying fair trade coffee and thinking that you're going to save the world through your consumerism or something. Like, it's a way that you can take a trip to India or Kenya or Ecuador that's marketed to you in this very like exoticized type of way and sort of pretend like you're helping the locals in the process, where, you know, what you're really doing is being taught to, you know, make your own chocolate in like an authentic local hut that's probably, you know, kind of just like a tourist trap. That's certainly my impression. But so, you know, in theory, this for-profit wing that has tons of corporate sponsorship. I mean, oil companies, mining companies, Microsoft, things like that, all get kind of prominent spots in these We Days, which are huge sponsorship opportunities. As you're an impressionable young person being told that you're going to save the world, you can look around you in a stadium and see emblazoned the logos of, like, you know, Potash Corporation and Microsoft and all kinds of other extremely benevolent actors on the world stage. Anyway, it's become increasingly clear that, you know, these two organizations, the line between them is a lot more porous. Money seems to flow between them, kind of goes back and forth. They actually have the same CFO. And when it comes to the for-profit wing, 90% of its sponsorship comes from just 20 companies, and they're all big ones. RBC Bank, KPMG, which is an accounting firm, Cineplex, the movie chain, they're sponsors like that. And I think perhaps the most revealing thing that's leaked out of all of this are some of the kind of internal presentations that the organization uses to attract sponsorship. reading from a Vice report on this, a page on Wii's website advertising Mark Kilberger, so the brother of Craig, as a paid speaker, touts his insights into, quote, purposeful and profitable business strategies. The page, which has since been updated to remove that language, boasts that Mark can help teach strategies to, quote, inspire brand fanatics to stay loyal to you, your company, and your cause, and add a halo effect to your product. In one internal pitch, the organization has even touted its youth programs as opportunities for partners to, quote, improve their brand reputation, particularly by increasing consumer perception of partners' investment in their local community. Goes on to suggest that sponsoring MeToWe can, quote, drive consumer exploration, consideration, and purchase of products and services. So in the interpretation that becomes more and more irresistible as you're reading this stuff, you know, it certainly looks like what this organization has done is built this extremely robust brand around, you know, a very vague idea of social justice. And it's used that to go to large corporations and large companies and tell them, we'll sell you a piece of this if you sponsor our events. So it really seems like an example of kind of neoliberal charity in a nutshell. And the whole thing, of course, fronted by this image of celebrity.
I'm actually, as you're talking, crafting a freelance pitch, which I hope will be accepted by either The Guardian or The Atlantic, called This is What a Political Scandal Looks Like in Canada. And it says, things are pretty bad in the United States, but would you believe it that up north, the Prime Minister is in trouble for hiring a charity?
The Prime Minister is in, the biggest scandal in Canada is that the Prime Minister was trying to help people. Folks!
I gotta say, I'm not crazy about the liberal corruption, but when you compare it to what's going on down south with the Orange Monster, it doesn't look too bad.
Well, have you been reading through my Twitter mentions as I've been talking about this?
You've observed before that the pattern of a response to a liberal scandal always starts with, first, there's no way he did this, and then secondly, well, maybe he did it, but it was totally ethical, and third is, okay, it wasn't ethical, but what are you going to do, vote for Andrew Scheer?
Well, and then there's the other stage in that is Justin Trudeau will offer some kind of apology, you know, some very careful, qualified apology.
And we're very impressed by the apology.
Yeah, right. We're all supposed to celebrate how magnanimous the apology was. One of my favorite Trudeau moments ever, one of the moments I think is probably most emblematic of what he's about, was after it emerged in the thickets of the 2019 election that he had donned blackface more times than he was willing to put a number on. A reporter was asking him at a press conference about this and referred to it as, you know, putting on a costume or something. And then Trudeau proceeded to correct them. And he said, like, something to the effect of, well, I mean, you described it as a costume, but I think we need to call this out for what it was. This was racist blackface, whatever. So that's the Trudeau brand in a nutshell.
That's a chess player right there, right?
Yeah, yeah. It reminded me of that Onion or Clickhole piece that was like, speaking as a male feminist, I think I would absolutely crush if I was accused of sexual assault. Anyway, I think there's a lot in the Wii scandal that speaks to deeper problems with the political culture in Canada. I think that the interpretation of the Wii organization that I've offered, I mean, you could very much say that Trudeau has elevated the same model to a national scale. And the Trudeau brand, if it's about anything, and, you know, a big source of its appeal, really is the idea that progress and the status quo really go hand in hand. There's a kind of seamless relationship between all of the actors and institutions that are complicit in the status quo and the negation of whatever injustice exists in the status quo. So Justin Trudeau is not somebody who denies that injustice exists in Canada. In fact, he's somebody who from the very beginning has absolutely bent over backwards to, you know, use the correct words and to bear witness to things, you know, racial injustice. Trudeau famously, 2015 election, called himself a feminist, that kind of thing. But then Trudeau also talked a lot about taxing the rich and how about, you know, he's talked a lot about, particularly on the world stage, about how inequality is a problem. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that, I'm sorry, this is paywalled, so I can say this, but I mean, I think the media in Canada and parts of the press gallery are so unbelievably credulous when they report on this stuff. I remember when Trudeau gave a speech in Hamburg, you know, at this kind of posh black tie dinner with kind of, you know, something like the Davos crowd. And, you know, he talked about inequality and, you know, growing global inequality and, you know, the need for fair taxation and things like that. When this was discussed in Canada in the press, you know, you had Toronto Star articles and stuff that were pushing the idea that, you know, the populist winds are about to blow into Canada. You know, look for big, you know, tax and spend stuff and, you know, in what is going to be the most activist federal budget we've seen in decades when that drops in a few months. And of course, none of that stuff happened. But then furthermore, when you actually look at Trudeau's speech, it is essentially just a pitch for class harmony. What he's telling the crowd is that if people start to perceive that the system is unfair, they will start losing trust in their institutions. And one of the things he specifically says is they will start to mistrust their employers. When Trudeau made his big, what was supposed to be his big inequality pitch back in, I think, 2013 or 2014, he wrote an op-ed in the Globe and Mail that I've been trying to draw attention to for years. I can't try as I might get this inserted into kind of the canon of Trudeau stuff, but I think it's really important. His big op-ed pitching, you know, how we have to fight inequality, he specifically says, these are his words, that if something isn't done to address inequality, Canadians will, quote, withdraw their support for a growth agenda. That's the phrase he uses. And he says they will start to look for convenient scapegoats and to kind of tidy solutions to their problems rather than, you know, sensible middle of the road ones or something like that. Again, essentially just a pitch for class harmony. The problem isn't inequality as kind of a moral one. The problem isn't a system that produces it. The problem is that the outcomes of the current system are undermining people's faith in it, and we have to restore perceptions of that system so that it can continue working as it should. This applies to a whole bunch of other things. Climate change, right? Trudeau's postured as a global leader on that. But his government has pumped billions into, among other things, nationalizing a pipeline. Its official line on the oil sands is that we need to expand the extraction of oil in order to subsidize a transition to clean energy, again implying that the status quo and you know, a necessary transformation of society can somehow go kind of hand in hand, and there's no conflict that needs to punctuate any of this. And so I think this is a feature that you see of neoliberalism everywhere. We've talked about things like fair trade coffee, things like that. There's all kinds of initiatives in this vein, some of them well-meaning and some of them really absurd. But I think it is a distinctive feature of Canadian politics and of neoliberalism, liberalism with a big and a small L there. Neoliberalism in Canada has masked itself behind this kind of celebrity figure. The most successful incarnation of it has masked itself behind this celebrity figure who is a master of kind of the shallowest political symbolism, a master of kind of gaming the feel-good clickbait economy that now drives so much of the media. And just like you go to a We Day celebration and hear this kind of secular evangelism about freeing the children and fighting poverty while being surrounded by corporate logos, you know, all the worst features of neoliberalism, all the most destructive things that it does, that it encourages, that it facilitates, big business essentially running the government, government subsidizing it, toxic resource extraction that's destroying the planet, insiderism and patronage, collaboration with, American border agencies while the government officially says nice things about refugees, yada, yada. Neoliberalism in Canada always comes, you know, with a patina of celebrity and a mawkish smile and a kind of nod towards inclusion. And I think one of the unspoken stories of Justin Trudeau's popularity abroad is that liberals in other countries have looked to this and they've kind of been like, whoa, what's your secret?